This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The panic buying started pretty early in the coronavirus pandemic. In most of the United States, it came before the stay-at-home orders or the closing of restaurants and shops. It's hard to pinpoint the moment when it began, but you get a sense it started slowly at first, and then it was hard to find toilet paper on the shelves or disinfectant wipes. And those things made some kind of logical sense. But if you look at the news stories from around the country, the stuff flying off the shelves often seemed more random than anything else. Tortillas, fire logs, all natural peanut butter. And all of this made us wonder, why? What was behind the panic buying? How do you explain this kind of mass behavior? And then we also wondered where Utah fit in the story, because Utahns have done more than their fair share of panic buying during this pandemic. So is it hysteria? Is it just simple self-preservation? And, you know, what does it reveal about human nature? When really bad stuff happens, can we count on ourselves as a species to come together or to freak out? Joining us first on the program is Dr. Damir Haramovic. He's a psychiatrist at Northwell Health's North Shore University Hospital in Manhasset, New York, editor of the book Psychiatry of Pandemics, A Mental Health Response to Infectious Outbreak. And Dr. Haramovic, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Good morning, or actually good afternoon. It's 1 p.m. here in New York.
I wanted to begin with something you mention in the book, that you say few experiences are so profound and so terrifying as the fear of being struck by a grave contagion. Lay the groundwork for why it is that people behave the way they do. You say this really is something really deep inside of us, that there's something, it seems like really profound deep inside, I guess.
There is. It almost strikes like a primal response in humans, because this disaster is unlike any other. In any other disaster, all you can expect to happen, or the most you can expect to happen, is basically you get killed or you get maimed or hurt in some way. But our age-old experiences with these infectious diseases tell us that, particularly if you think of the old days and the lepers and whatnot, that the disease really transforms you or transmogrifies you into someone else or something else that is different, maybe not human or subhuman, and hence this very primal fear of contracting the disease and treating those who have it or who have survived it. That's also going to be an interesting point of departure in for our society in the months to come. But that is a unique feature of a pandemic or an infectious disease. So we are really afraid that we are going to emerge from this entire experience as someone different, perhaps less human than we were, if we get if we get the affliction. Hence the whole subgenre, or the now genre of zombie movies, kind of leads to that very, very primal fear.
Yeah,
but
wanna...
for a very limited time of about 19 minutes.
Right. I want to come back to that, actually. I find that really interesting. But how do these moments of pandemics or, you know, plagues, how do they shape societies and culture over time? How does that primal fear shape our culture, as far as you can tell?
I'd say it's, you know, we have been shaped immensely. Now, this is really a question more for historians and sociologists or anthropologists. But in my experience doing the research for this book, I kind of realized that pandemics are really, in a way, a bookends to our civilization, because our civilizations and the first recorded accounts start with the recounting, you know, the 10 plagues of Egypt in the Book of Exodus. And then if you take a look at more of an eschatological end of our society or civilization, the end of days are also deeply steeped in all these outbreaks and whatnot that happens. So, you know, it begins and it ends with a pandemic, or at least pandemic being a part of it. Also, they have shaped our history immensely from, you know, the first recorded ones, which were in the Athens, who helped Sparta prevail over Athens at the time, Rome, Byzantine, the Justinian plague that thwarted the Byzantine Empire from retaking Rome, the Black Death. Even some speculate that the Spanish flu of 1918 actually helped turn the tides of war and somehow brought the war to a quicker ending. As I said, I'm not a historian. So they have shaped us tremendously. If you look at the arts and the science and everything that came out of the Black Death and the plague of the 14th and 15th century, basically the entire Renaissance was based on the experience that people had as some sort of a purgatory experience that they had during the century of the plague, and then that kind of paved way for more scientifically based, more humanistic society that emerged at the end of that experience.
Okay, so let's talk about the psychological impact, the emotional impact. You describe the public reaction, all of this anxiety spreading, you say, in the same way as the virus, that the reaction to the virus mirrors the pandemic itself. Talk about that.
That is correct, and that is yet another unique feature of a pandemic or infectious disease outbreak, that you have this thing, we can call it the emotional epidemiology, as Danielle Offrey did a few years ago, or we can find some other way, but you clearly have something that shadows, like the shadow pandemic that follows and sometimes heralds, sometimes follows the actual outbreak. And I think you basically can attest to that more so than we here in New York, because we're so much immersed in an actual outbreak here that we really don't know what else is going on. And I think every bit of anxiety is justified, but you have limited number of cases, yet there has been so much, so many measures already implemented publicly. And people have been doing this panic buying and whatnot. So you can see that there is something about the pandemic that's not just the pandemic itself, but rather it spreads like a contagion in the sphere of emotional and mental kind of psychological aspect as well.
Okay, so like the key thing that we were wondering about was why the buying of toilet paper? And maybe not just that particular thing in of itself, but what was it about the panic buying, the hoarding that was going on in these initial moments of all of this? Why are people panic buying? How do you explain that? I mean, we can talk about the details as we go, but generally, what do you think is going on there?
There are a couple of things going on. The only thing that I really can't tell you anything about is the toilet paper thing. I mean, and nowhere in my research have I found that there is going to be a demand for toilet paper under any circumstances. So I guess the best way to, you know, finally answer that question would be to ask the people who are hoarding the toilet paper and ask them, why are you buying tons and tons of that?
Yeah.
But people in... A lot of times people have this intuitive sense of things going wrong and kind of this impending sense of loss of control that is approaching with an approaching pandemic actually makes sense. And one of the ways they want to compensate for that loss of control is to basically try and exercise control where they can, such as load up their pantry and whatnot, their garage, so that they can actually have some additional resources when, you know, in case things go really, really bad. And you know, a lot of people do think that things can go really bad. I mean, look at all the preppers and people who kind of do that on a routine basis. So it's something that exists in the community and just managed to spread during this particular event. Another reason why people may be doing it, in addition to exercising control and kind of, you know, really trying to provide some supplies for themselves, they may be stocking up on individual items and whatnot, because they may believe that in case of a total societal breakdown, it's better to hold on to something and have something to barter with than to have nothing and just depend on people who may not be willing to share what they have.
we sometimes talk about it as a character flaw. And I think, you know, there's some of the hoarding that is fairly despicable, let's say. But is panic buying of toilet paper, is that a flaw? Is that a flaw, I guess, as you see it?
It all depends on how you look at it. All these human behaviors that we see are basically deeply ingrained, and to an extent, in certain circumstances, they have a very reasonable purpose. It is only when it gets out of what we call normal and interferes with one functioning that we even venture to diagnose someone with mental disorder. So I'm not really sure if we could really describe this as a flaw. I mean, you can say from a moral perspective or some other perspective, but from a psychiatric perspective, I'm not really sure we could.
Yeah. I wonder if are people behaving, are they modeling other behavior? Like when people go to the store, let's say they didn't go in with the intent of buying, you know, 17 packages of toilet paper, but they saw this, like, what is the psychological or psychiatric explanation for people modeling this other behavior that someone else is doing it, I must do it? Like, is there something like that going on?
There is absolutely something like that going on. People really don't know what to expect with this situation approaching kind of rapidly, you know, on the horizon and rapidly approaching and engulfing the entire community, the entire society. We have not been prepared consciously, intellectually for something like this. So we go to a store and we basically try to figure out what we may need. And then we see this guy who is kind of loading up on, I don't know, 3 tons of water or toilet paper. And the first thing that comes to mind, because we all have this information gap. We have a need for information for the fact, and we don't have them. And so we are all experiencing anxiety because of that. And so we see this guy who kind of seems like he knows what he's doing. And the first thing that comes to mind is, well, maybe he knows something that I don't, so I better do what he does, and you know, stocking up on water makes sense, and so on and so forth, or toilet paper or what have you. And that's, I mean, that's how things go. I mean, yes, in this case you probably can expect to see that the sanitizer and these sanitizing wipes would have legitimate use, and stocking up on those would make sense. But once you see people doing all sorts of stuff, you go to a store and everybody's buying oranges. Do oranges protect me from the virus? Why is this guy buying this stuff? Like, what does he know that I don't? You know what? Let me be sure. Now that I'm here, I may as well just load up on oranges and go home.
Yeah. How does it change things, doctor, when you cannot see the enemy? The enemy has no ideology. The enemy has no sense of favor. How does that change things?
It changes things tremendously, but enemy doesn't have to have ideology. We do. And we will use the ideology to help frame what is going on and then kind of cast the ones who don't fit into our ideology as the ones who may be, you know, quote unquote, conspiring with the enemy. So it is, again, a different type of a situation. I wouldn't really call it a war. It is a disaster of sorts, and it's a naturally occurring event. But it definitely makes it a little bit more difficult and more complicated. And then we, as I said, we apply and project our own ideologies, our own values, in order to help understand and make sense of it. Just wanted to add, which is something that we didn't get to address in our book, you can use these agents in warfare as well, and it's called biological warfare, and so you may actually have the enemy behind this. Yeah. And I'm not saying that's the case in the current pandemic, but that just complicates matters further in case that happens.
You write in your book that pandemics include not just the spread of, you know, physical illness, but the dissemination at times of racist and homophobic language. What's going on there, as far as you can tell?
Again, once you realize that there is this threat, then you feel the need to protect yourself and your loved ones, and you fall back on your pretty basic and core beliefs, and those may include perceptions of other cultures or other races, and it gets to your limbic system, and your limbic system gets activated, and you are using the most primitive reasoning to basically figure out what may be safe and okay, and what may be threatening, and are people who look different the ones who are the threat and carry the virus, or are the people who talk different? All sorts of things come into play. Also, what's going to happen to us? We're probably not aware of that. After this thing is over, we're probably not going to be a very popular nation on the face of the earth. People are going to refer to us, you know, the way people used to treat travelers from China early in the outbreak. That's how people are going to be treating us once this is over.
Come back to what you were saying earlier about why it is that we indulge in like zombie movies, because you talk about how we indulge in experiences for entertainment purposes. What is it about a zombie movie that helps us deal with what's going on?
I'm not sure if the zombie movie at this point would help us deal with what is going on, but help a zombie movie, like any horror movie or any activity that involves thrill, basically serves to kind of tickle some of our deepest fears without necessarily completely having us immersed in them and really living them in reality. And so we can allow ourselves to go and see the zombie movie in which most, if not all, zombie movies in the last 20 years or so basically are spread by way of infection, which is interesting because the initial concept of zombies was not really about infection, and you don't become a zombie if you get in touch with another one. But that really caught on and apparently resonates with something deep inside of us. And that would be this fear of losing our own humanity. So we can kind of go into a movie theater, look on the screen what that would look like, and feel genuinely horrified, have genuine primal fear and then terror, experience it very briefly. And then we kind of say, oof, that was close. It was a nice movie. Time to go home. But this time, you know, we're actually living in it. But also, what is really good, you know, the infection does not really turn people into zombies.
Right. Let me ask you, do you think that, again, not to put a good or a bad to this necessarily, but does this bring out the worst parts of us, or does it also seem to bring out the best of us? I mean, something that might also be explained by our natural instincts of social solidarity and kinship, the idea that we've seen a lot of people really doing, you know, great things coming together in really important ways. Seems like there's a mix of both maybe there.
Someone actually asked me that question the other day, and I realized that situations like this tend to accentuate a lot of things and a lot of features, and it's not only about the good and bad. Those people who inherently tend to react by being useful and helping others will find themselves frauded and kind of motivated to do the same thing. Those who believe that humans are really not to be trusted and you're better off going it alone and kind of not really taking care of the others because they may be the source of infection, will find also verification for their positions and attitudes, and they will pursue their own thing. And that's pretty much like with everything else. People who tend to cope well with a stressful situation will cope well and will thrive and do good things and be able to help others. Those who really don't tolerate stress well will tend to crumble under stress, develop anxiety, depression, and what have you. And people who probably have a lot of money will find a way to make more, and those who don't will find themselves having even less at the end of this.
It's Dr. Damir Horimovic. He's the editor of the book Psychiatry of Pandemics, A Mental Health Response to Infection Outbreak. Doctor, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
KUER is an essential resource in your daily life. We're giving you reliable information about the coronavirus so you can make smart decisions for yourself, your family, and your community. You're an essential part of KUER's daily life, too. Our contributing listeners provide the largest share of our funding, money that fuels our editorial independence. You're going to continue to count on KUER. We're hoping we can count on you. Give at KUER.org/donate.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the psychology of panic buying, which reveals a lot about group behavior. And the thing is, panic buying itself is not that easy to track, but you can measure shopping trends. And there's a company that does this. It's a tech business called Womply. And part of what they do is they collect consumer data and they go hunting for trends. Brad Plothow is with Womply, and he told us, when the coronavirus pandemic hit, they happened to be paying attention to what people around the country were buying. And Utah really stuck out.
When COVID-19 hit, we started to see that the economic ripple effects were going to be coming. And one of the things that we saw very, very early on was this massive spike in grocery store and supermarket sales. We saw this happen back in March. And then we saw something happen last week. In the second and third week of April, and the spike started again. And when we dug in deeper and looked at the state level, we saw that Utah was far and away leading the charge. 275% increase in grocery store sales compared to the previous year. No state compares to Utah in terms of panic buying of groceries during COVID-19. That's pretty clear based on the data we're looking at. And this is a very unusual thing because the next highest state was seeing like an 80 or 90% year-over-year increase in grocery store sales. So that certainly got our attention. So a couple of our theories that we've batted around, one is that, you know, Utah has a culture that's prone to preparation, self-sufficiency. They want to make sure that they're taking care of their families. They also have larger families. So if you're going to be preparing for potentially a long period of time in which you're going to be stuck at home, your bulk buying is going to be a much more significant ticket size than in another state where they have smaller households on average. And certainly we think that that's playing into the trends that we're seeing here. I will admit that I'm part of this. So when we first had the COVID-19 closures start to happen, the schools started to close, we spent $1,000 at Costco. You know, we want to look out for our friends and neighbors. And ironically, one of the ways that we've sort of chosen to do that is to be well provisioned ourselves. So I think one of the weird ironies here is that, you know, when you have a culture where people like to provide for their families and also potentially provide service to other people, that does lead to these interesting incentives around stocking up. There is a certain amount of anxiety that comes with anything that's uncertain. So the uncertainty is the only thing that feels like it's known at this point.
It's Brad Plothow. He's vice president of corporate marketing for the company Womply. So Utahns, it turns out, are number one, I guess you could say that, number one in panic buying. And so why would that be? What is it that's particularly distinctive about this state from other states? And of course, the thing that comes to mind is the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And we wondered, what role did Mormon culture play in this story, if it did? Joining us now on the program is Dr. Christopher Blythe. He is a research associate at the Neil A. Maxwell Institute for Religious Scholarship, author of the upcoming book, Terrible Revolution, Latter-day Saints and the American Apocalypse. Dr. Blythe, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
And Matthew Bowman is also with us. He's an associate professor of history and religion at Claremont Graduate University, also the Howard W. Hunter Chair of Mormon Studies. And Matthew Bowman, welcome back to you.
Thanks, Doug.
All right, gentlemen, I wanted to start with a question of what do you make of the results that we were just talking about there a moment ago, that Utahns are number one in panic buying? Do the things that you know about the Utah culture, the LDS part of the culture, obviously, does that help explain that in some way? To you, Christopher Blythe, you start.
Sure. You know, I think that's absolutely right. We have a culture in place that's predisposed to be mindful of the possibility of large-term crises. Many of us have spent a lot of money preparing for the idea of having several months or even a year supply of food. So for a culture that's placed a premium on trying to prepare, at least to that degree, those of us that might have delayed gathering a year's supply or a few months' supply, it makes sense that there'd be an increase in shopping amongst us for sure.
Matt Bowman, what do you think? Does Mormon culture contribute to the way people are reacting, as far as you can tell?
Yeah, well, I would add to what Chris just said, right, that there is certainly a long tradition of this in Mormon culture, going back through a number of struggles and disasters from really the trek west through the Great Depression and the Cold War to the present. So, you know, there certainly is, I think, a tradition both in terms of reacting to certain events, but also simply in the church's direction to its members.
How connected do you figure most mainstream Latter-day Saints today are to this idea of this pandemic as being some message from God, you know, a sign of the last days approaching, and therefore it's motivating them by quite a bit to buy more toilet paper and canned goods and other things? So how much are they seeing this as these are the last days, as far as you can figure? Let's see. Dr. Blythe, you start there.
Thanks, Doug. You know, I've been getting two or three phone calls a day asking about different prophecies and things, old friends, as well as people just know about my work. And so I think that's out there. I think there's a lot of people wondering whether this is a key moment to the timeline leading up to the second coming. And even we see some of that at the recent general conference of the church, a discussion of the second coming and preparing for it, not through the gathering of supplies or food, but an awareness, a general idea that the second coming is near. So I do think Latter-day Saints have that idea present. And I think, you know, the church has often been even though this might be hard to believe from those that kind of study the church or know about the church peripherally, the organization, the church often is less extreme than members. And so encourages moderation, the sort of gradual gathering of supplies and food storage, an idea that the second coming is in the generations ahead, but not tomorrow. Whereas I think now there's more of a willingness at this moment to pay attention to what I'd call folk prophecies and other things generated amongst membership. And I do, I get a lot of phone calls just asking questions about things that would point them in a more anxious expression of end times beliefs just in the last couple months.
So what you're saying is leaders are saying, hey guys, hold on, don't overreact to this, but there's an inclination among some members anyway to just kind of freelance, and that's where you get these kind of folk ideas that take hold. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. There's a very popular video going across the membership of the church in the Wasatch Front right now, a YouTube video that's gotten nearly 400,000 views in the past month, that makes a case for these events being within the next couple years or in the moment we're at. This is not the message you're getting if you're watching General Conference or seeing quotes from general church leaders talking about coronavirus and so on.
Matthew Bowman, what do you think about that? It seems like, I guess, what are you hearing? Because it seems like there is a sense that that some Latter-day Saints are seeing in a lot of the change that's going on in the presidency of Russell M. Nelson that he's just preparing people for this, and that the fact that there was this earthquake and the fact that there's this pandemic is just sort of part of the mix, and Russell Nelson saw it coming.
Yeah, you know, this is, I think Chris is right, and this is certainly an inclination among some members of the church. And I think there's a kind of complex web of reasons why that is. One reason I suspect is that Nelson has been more active than the immediate prior presidents of the church. But another is, I think, and Chris's term folk prophecy, I think, is well taken here, is that there has been, I think, especially in the past 50 or 60 years of the church, a tendency among many members to go prophecy hunting, right? Mm-hmm. And particularly as the church has gradually emphasized the authority, the prophetic authority, particularly of its leadership since the correlation movement of the 60s, that there is an inclination among many members, right, to ascribe to their leadership secret knowledge, right, to guess about things that their leaders are doing and to read into them these really kind of profound insights that may or may not be there. Certainly. So, yeah, I think there is, and you know, this is common, I think, in many religious traditions, but there is a real tendency among certain factions of the membership to embroider, to generate folk theology, to start seeing things that may or may not be there. And, of course, in many Christian traditions in the United States, the second coming is the big one of all of that. And so this is, yes, you know, this is common among a lot of Christian denominations.
So I guess I was wondering if the LDS Church's history through all of this is that much different from any other Christian religion in the way it thinks about the you know, the end days. Early Mormon leaders like Joseph Smith, Christopher Blythe, taught about an impending apocalypse and an end of times. How does that play into all of this?
Yeah, you know, Latter-day Saints from 1820, you know, the origins of the Latter-day Saint tradition to the present have an idea that they're living in the last days. I mean, this is an essential component to Latter-day Saint belief. But even with Joseph Smith, we have a tendency to push it off a bit. So Joseph Smith lived in a time where Seventh-day Adventists had their precursors, the Millerite movement, that believed the second coming was going to happen between 1843 and 1844. And Smith's response was that he had had a revelation that that was false, that it wouldn't happen until at least 1890. So in other words, he pushed it back a generation, right?
And it seems like all the leaders pushed it back a generation. They just said, no, it's coming, but not yet.
That's right.
Yeah,
I think that's kind of a sense that we get through time. A few leaders don't capture that theme the same way, whereas I think there's always been a general, you know, maybe it'll happen in our children's lifetime. Maybe it'll happen when we're very old. A few leaders have thought, no, it's going to happen next year. And you'll see a lot of pushback to that through the mainstream of church leadership. But I do think that's key. This, if I was going to trace a general idea that people are seeing it in a time frame, but absolutely, that's been there from the beginning and continues to be there. Things are different today. Most importantly, what I emphasize in my book is that, you know, the great enemy of early Latter-day Saints was the United States government. And yeah, so much of the emphasis in early references to prophecy are about the collapse of the federal government. Whereas today that has no place in Latter-day Saint prophecy, certainly not emphasized amongst mainstream members of the church.
What you write about is that they, that the Mormon faithful, they kind of switched the narrative a bit. It stopped being – the enemy stopped being the United States, and so they went looking for something else that was going to be sort of the bad guy in the story. Do I have that right?
That's absolutely right, and that's getting to your larger question. That's where I think Latter-day Saint perceptions of the Second Coming are a lot closer to evangelical or Pentecostal or Seventh-day Adventist understandings than they would have been 100 years ago. We're much closer to a wider Christian narrative of the Second Coming, with some key differences, of course.
Yeah, yeah. So part of the – it seems like at some point, and this was true of a lot of Americans, is that the Russians started to become the enemy. One of the things you write about is that the atomic bomb, you say, changed the way American Christians imagined the apocalypse, which gets us to how this plays out in the 20th century. Christopher Blythe, talk a little bit about that, if you would. And Matthew Bowman, I want to hear you on this point, too.
Oh, I think this is key turning point. And you're absolutely right. Russians, communists, become for a time the bad guys that previously were the federal government. And today I think there's still, there's a runoff from that time period. During Obama's presidency, I once heard a popular Latter-day Saint speaker, not a member of the church leadership at all, but say that Obama was linked to Marx, and this was a great last days, emphasis was Obama was the Antichrist in this last day's story. So there's still some runoff to it. But earlier in the 1950s, I think it's key. The atomic bomb comes around, and now we understand how a world could come to a great cataclysmic event. And we see some members of the church leadership, J. Reuben Clark, for example, who take this very seriously, who tells his own children that they should move off to the family ranch when the first bomb falls in the United States. So like many Americans, Latter-day Saints took the communist threat and certainly the new technology as apocalyptic events, confirming their reading of books of Isaiah and Revelation.
Matthew Bowman, tell us about this, how it transforms almost into a kind of right-wing ideology. Ezra Taft Benson is a major player in this part of the story, it seems.
Yeah, certainly. One of the interesting things that happens within the LDS tradition in the mid-20th century is the absorption of this long, long tradition of conservative evangelical theology that gradually pieced together over 40, 50 years various verses from the Bible and knit them together into a consistent narrative about precisely how the end of the world was going to come. And of course, this is where the notion of the Antichrist comes. This is where the notion of a one world government that will be opposed to God comes from. And some LDS leaders, Joseph Fielding Smith in particular, are reading some of this theology, and they start embroidering it with verses from the Book of Mormon and the Doctrine and Covenants. And by the 1940s and 50s, you have the emergence of this kind of uniquely LDS understanding of these stories. And of course, because these stories do require a great villain, right, an Antichrist figure, whom some earlier evangelicals believed was Mussolini, perhaps, or Adolf Hitler. After these people are gone, they start looking with suspicion at the Soviet Union. They also start looking with suspicion at the United Nations. Right, this sort of fear of a large one-world government is really close to the heart of this. And of course, then, that's easily transferred into suspicion of government generally. Right, of the fear of a distant power that's going to control us, that's anti-religion, that's going to eliminate our liberties and our freedoms. Right, and so, as you mentioned, with people like Ezra Taft Benson, Cleon Skousen is another major LDS writer who thinks this way. These ideas begin percolating really in certain aspects of culture in Utah and in the West more generally.
When did the idea of having a year supply or is it 2 year supply? When did all of that kick in?
It goes back and forth. There really are requirements set, or I shouldn't say requirements necessarily, but an expectation, right? Leaders advising church members to lay up food storage. It goes all the way back to, of course, the trek west in the settlement of Utah. When you're living on the frontier, this is, you know, just sort of commonsensical to do. But that advice kicks in late in the Great Depression, around the time of the institution of the welfare program. And at that point, it's framed, right, as part of preparation for economic disaster, like, of course, the Great Depression was. And this links very nicely in the Cold War with, of course, some preparation for nuclear holocaust, right? This is the time when many Americans are purchasing fully stocked nuclear bunkers for installations in their backyards. And these things have beds and food and, you know, and can openers and all the rest. And food storage just fits in very neatly with that general American impulse. Since the end of the Cold War, the expectation for the amount of food storage has declined from a year, 2 years, to just several months at this point. But I think its roots in some of these cataclysms of the 20th century are fairly clear.
Christopher Blythe, anything to add to that point?
I think that's great. You know, I think Matt's right. We had this official year supply, and amongst membership, we began to have an idea that maybe a year supply isn't quite enough. 2 years is the best thing you could possibly do. And there's a series of legends that started about the 1970s and 1960s, well, really 1970s, where prophets or even angels, the three Nephites, are instructing people to make sure they get their food supply.
Wow.
And don't
wow.
do it in a few years, do it now.
You got to tell some of these stories. Tell the story. I think there's an elevator involved in one of these great stories.
Yeah. You know, one of the folklore pieces that I find most interesting is one that started, we can trace this, what we call a legend cycle, to 1976 and 1977. There was a general conference talk by a man named Bonjay Featherstone, who told people in that talk, and this is an actual story, that they needed to get all of their food supply together within a year, more rigorous than any other general authority had ever said. They need to have a year supply. They need to have it within a year. And that if they needed to sell their valuable items, they should do so. They yeah. should prioritize this. And of course, the church would dial that back very quickly. But on the popular front, we see these new stories showing up. And one is of the prophet Spencer W. Kimball, who comes across usually a female church employee in the elevator. And it always changes. Sometimes she's carrying Christmas gifts. And Spencer W. Kimball turns to her and says, you know, if you knew what I knew, you would return those gifts and use the money for a year's supply of food. At other times, she says she's excited to go on a honeymoon. And he says, if you knew what I knew, you'd skip the honeymoon and buy your food storage. Other times, she has a wonderful wedding ring. And he says, if you know what I knew, you'd sell that ring and you'd go get your storage. It's great. This story has, you know, there's about 20 of them on file at the folklore archive that my wife runs at BYU, in which they have all different variants, but that one line is the same, if you knew what I knew. And so we frequently see those stories as the prophet having this sure knowledge that next year is going to be the year. Other times, also started in the late 60s, we have a mysterious traveler hitchhiking on the highway who good Latter-day Saints pick up to drive to the next town. And the passenger reveals himself as a three Nephite later, but initially asks them about their food storage and says, do you have your 2 year supply? And when they turn around and look at him, he says, get your food storage. And just like that, he disappears.
Wow.
Really, really interesting moment in the 60s and 70s for folk stories about the necessity of food storage and food storage right now.
Hmm. So what happened to this idea, this impulse for food storage? You mentioned earlier that it sort of started to diminish. Did it go dormant? And it, with the coronavirus, is it back? As far as you can both tell, Dr. Blythe, you begin if you would.
Yeah, I don't think it's ever entirely gone away. We definitely see it less prevalently discussed in the church, but the church has occasionally reminded people that they should have 3 months' supply. And with the coronavirus, I would think that that discussion has become much more popular, and that council practiced much more regularly. But I actually don't think we see the sort of year supply purchasing right now. I'm sure there's more of that in the past year, but as you've already pointed out, the sort of items being purchased are interesting. And maybe they deal with people preparing for just a few months and a whole lot of them, rather than a sort of long-term prepping.
Wait, you mean so like it's not wheat, it's something else?
Yeah, I think people are purchasing toilet paper in vast supply and all sorts of specific items. But I don't know if we have a sort of, as I'm thinking right now about the sort of preppers that I study who keep 2 years supply and have developed all sorts of technologies and trainings that they think are going to be key for an apocalyptic scenario. I don't know if we have the same I don't know if the prepper movement itself is going to come out of this huge, but I do think there's a sort of specific supply gathering that probably will become a more regular feature around Latter-day Saint culture, perhaps.
So, Matthew Bowman, what are we going to hear from Mormon church leaders, do you think? I mean, they said hardly anything the last general conference, at least as far as I could tell about any of that. Are you going to start hearing this kind of language now in speeches? And
well, you know, I'm not surprised. It's uncommon generally for church leaders to comment on current events. So, you know, this one is particularly terrible. And so we might have expected a little bit more. I do think we'll hear a lot more from local members of the church than from church leaders, along the lines of what we've been discussing. That is, this disaster justifies and verifies all of this earlier counsel. Those stories that Chris has been discussing, I think, will probably begin circulating more. And I think there will be an uptick in the future among members of the church buying these sorts of storage.
Christopher Blythe, to you finally, one of the things you say is that the thing that you're noticing about these last day narratives is that the saints or their enemies are no longer at the epicenter. So that seems to be the new twist about the way people are thinking, Mormon people anyway, are thinking about those the latter days, the last days?
I think it's less aimed at a conspiracy in the United States itself. We're less isolationist minded, so we're part of society. And that's very different than the way a 19th century Latter-day Saint would think about the last days, particularly with an idea that persecution is widespread and safety is outside of that society. So what's it look like, which is part of what the book looks at, what's it look like when you think these destructions and crises are happening to you as well as your neighbor, rather than somehow you find a way out of that crisis?
The book is Terrible Revolution, Latter-day Saints and the American Apocalypse. It's coming out soon. Christopher Blythe?
I sure hope so.
Good luck with that. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thanks, Doug.
And Matthew Bowman, Associate Professor of History and Religion at Claremont Graduate University, the Howard W. Hunter Chair of Mormon Studies there. Thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks, Doug.
Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. As always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. Our intern is Natu Twe, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.